Lavinia by Ursula K. Le Guin. DB 67310. Copyright 2008 by Ursula K. Le Guin. Read by Jill Fox. This book contains 279 pages. Approximate reading time, 10 hours, 5 minutes. This book contains markers allowing direct access to the beginning of the book, the afterword, and the acknowledgments. Library of Congress Annotation. Ancient Italy. King Latinus's daughter Lavinia, from Virgil's The Aeneid, RC 64204, is pressured to marry Turnus, despite prophecies that she will wed a foreigner and cause a war. When Trojan ships arrive bearing hero Aeneas, Lavinia discovers true love and her destiny. Some descriptions of sex and some violence, 2008. From the book jacket. In The Aeneid, Virgil's hero fights to claim the king's daughter Lavinia, with whom he is destined to found an empire. Lavinia herself never speaks a word in the poem. Now Ursula K. Le Guin gives her a voice in a novel that takes us to the half-wild world of ancient Italy, when Rome was a muddy village near Seven Hills. Lavinia grows up knowing nothing but peace and freedom, until suitors come. Her mother demands that she marry handsome, ambitious Turnus. But omens and prophecies spoken by the sacred springs say she must marry a foreigner, that she will be the cause of a bitter war, and that her husband will not live long. When a fleet of Trojan ships sails up the Tiber, Lavinia decides to take her destiny into her own hands. And so she tells us what Virgil did not. The story of her life and of the love of her life. Lavinia is a book of passion and war, and the cost of war, generous and austerely beautiful, from a writer working at the height of her powers. About the author. Ursula K. Le Guin is the author of numerous short stories, essays, volumes of poetry, books for children, and novels. Among her honors are a National Book Award, 5 Hugo and 5 Nebula Awards, the Kafka Award, a Pushcart Prize, a Howard Vercel Award of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the P.E.N. Malamud Award. She lives in Portland, Oregon. Visit www.ursulakleguin.com. Other books by Ursula K. Le Guin. Tales from Earthsea, The Other Wind, The Telling, Changing Planes, Gifts, Voices, Powers. Reader's Note. The map found in the print edition is not included in this recording. End of note. Sola domum et tanta servabat filia sedis, jam matura viro, jam plenis nubilis anis. Multi illam magno elatio totaque petebant ausonia. A single daughter, now ripe for a man, now of full marriageable age, kept the great household. Many from broad Latium and all Ausonia came wooing her. I went to the salt beds by the mouth of the river, in the May of my 19th year, to get salt for the sacred meal. Tida and Maruna came with me, and my father sent an old house slave and a boy with a donkey to carry the salt home. It's only a few miles up the coast, but we made an overnight picnic of it, loading the poor little donkey with food, taking all day to get there, setting up camp on a grassy dune above the beaches of the river and the sea. The 5 of us had supper round the fire and told stories and sang songs while the sun set in the sea and the May dusk turned blue and bluer. Then we slept under the sea wind. I woke at the first beginning of light. The others were sound asleep. The birds were just beginning their dawn chorus. I got up and went down to the mouth of the river. I dipped up a little water and let it fall back as offering before I drank, sang the river's name, Tiber, Father Tiber, and his old secret names as well, Albu, Ruman. Then I drank, liking the half-salt taste of the water. The sky was light enough now that I could see the long, stiff waves at the bar where the current met the incoming tide. Out beyond that, on the dim sea, I saw ships, a line of great black ships, coming up from the south and wheeling and heading into the river mouth. On each side of each ship, a long rank of oars lifted and beat like the beat of wings in the twilight. One after another, the ships breasted the waves at the bar, rising and plunging. One after another, they came straight on. Their long, arched triple beaks were bronze. I crouched by the water in the salty mud. The first ship entered the river and came past me, dark above me, moving steadily to the heavy, soft beat of the oars on the water. The faces of the oarsmen were shadowed, but a man stood up against the sky on the high stern of the ship, gazing ahead. His face is stern, yet unguarded. He is looking ahead into the darkness, praying. I know who he is. By the time the last of the ships passed by me, with that soft labored beat and rush of oars, and vanished into the forest that grows thick on both banks, the birds were singing aloud everywhere, and the sky was bright above the eastern hills. I climbed back up to our camp. No one was awake. The ships had passed them in their sleep. I said nothing to them of what I had seen. We went down to the salt pans and dug up enough of the muddy gray stuff to make salt for the year's use, loaded it in the donkeys' baskets, and set off home. I did not let them linger, and they complained and dawdled a little, but we were home well before noon. I went to the king and said, "A great fleet of warships went up the river at dawn, father." He looked at me. His face was sad. "So soon," was all he said. I know who I was. I can tell you who I may have been. But I am now, only in this line of words I write. I'm not sure of the nature of my existence, and wonder to find myself writing. I speak Latin, of course, but did I ever learn to write it? That seems unlikely. No doubt someone with my name, Lavinia, did exist, but she may have been so different from my own idea of myself, or my poet's idea of me, that it only confuses me to think about her. As far as I know, it was my poet who gave me any reality at all. Before he wrote, I was the mistiest of figures, scarcely more than a name in a genealogy. It was he who brought me to life, to myself, and so made me able to remember my life and myself, which I do vividly, with all kinds of emotions. Emotions I feel strongly as I write, perhaps because the events I remember only come to exist as I write them, or as he wrote them. But he did not write them. He slighted my life in his poem. He scanted me because he only came to know who I was when he was dying. He's not to blame. It was too late for him to make amends, rethink, complete the half lines, perfect the poem he thought imperfect. He grieved for that, I know. He grieved for me. Perhaps where he is now, down there across the dark rivers, somebody will tell him that Lavinia grieves for him. I won't die. Of that, I am all but certain. My life is too contingent to lead to anything so absolute as death. I have not enough real mortality. No doubt I will eventually fade away and be lost in oblivion, as I would have done long ago if the poet hadn't summoned me into existence. Perhaps I will become a false dream, clinging like a bat to the underside of the leaves of the tree at the gate of the underworld, or an owl flitting in the dark oaks of Albania. But I won't have to tear myself from life and go down into the dark, as he did, poor man, first in his imagination, and then as his own ghost. "We each have to endure our own afterlife," he said to me once, or that is one way to understand what he said. But that dim loitering about, down in the underworld, waiting to be forgotten or reborn, that isn't true being. Not even half true as my being is as I write and you read it. And nowhere near as true as in his words, the splendid, vivid words I've lived in for centuries. And yet my part of them, the life he gave me in his poem, is so dull, except for the one moment when my hair catches fire, so colorless, except when my maiden cheeks blush like ivory stained with crimson dye. so conventional, I can't bear it any longer. If I must go on existing century after century, then once at least I must break out and speak. He didn't let me say a word. I have to take the word from him. He gave me a long life, but a small one. I need room. I need air. My soul reaches out into the old forests of my Italy, up to the sunlit hills, up to the winds of the swan and the truth-speaking crow. My mother was mad, but I was not. My father was old, but I was young. Like Spartan Helen, I caused a war. She caused hers by letting men who wanted her take her. I caused mine because I wouldn't be given, wouldn't be taken, but chose my man and my fate. The man was famous, the fate obscure. Not a bad balance. All the same, sometimes I believe I must be long dead and am telling this story in some part of the underworld that we didn't know about. A deceiving place where we think we're alive, where we think we're growing old and remembering what happened when we were young, when the bees swarmed and my hair caught fire, when the Trojans came. After all, how can it be that we can all talk to one another? I remember the foreigners from the other side of the world, sailing up the Tiber into a country they knew nothing of. Their envoy came to my father's house, explained that he was a Trojan, and made polite speeches in fluent Latin. Now, how could that be? Do we all know all the languages? That can be true only of the dead, whose land lies under all the other lands. How is it that you understand me, who lived 25 or 30 centuries ago? Do you know Latin? But then I think, no, it has nothing to do with being dead. It's not death that allows us to understand one another, but poetry. If you'd met me when I was a girl at home, you might well have thought that my poet's faint portrait of me, sketched as if with a brass pin on a wax tablet, was quite sufficient. A girl, a king's daughter, a marriageable virgin, chaste, silent, obedient, ready to a man's will as a field in spring is ready for the plow. I've never plowed, but I've watched our farmers at it all my life. The white ox trudging forward in the yoke, the man gripping the long wooden handles that buck and rear as he tries to force the plowshare through the soil that looks so meek and ready and is so tough, so shut. He strains with all his weight and muscle to make a scratch deep enough to hold the barley seed. He labors till he's gasping and shaking with exhaustion, and wants only to lie down in the furrow and sleep on his hard mother's breast among the stones. I never had to plow, but I had a hard mother, too. Earth will take the plowman in her arms at last and let him sleep deeper than the barley seed. But my mother had no embrace for me. I was silent and meek because if I spoke up, if I showed my will, she might remember that I was not my brother's, and I'd suffer for it. I was 6 when they died, little Atinas and baby Lawrence. They'd been my dears, my dolls. I played with them and adored them. My mother Amata watched over us, smiling as the spindle dropped and rose in her fingers. She didn't leave us with our nurse Vestina and the other women as a queen might do, but stayed with us all day long, for love. Often she sang to us as we played. Sometimes she stopped spinning and leapt up, took my hands and Latina's hands, and danced with us, and we all laughed together. "My warriors," she called the boys, and I thought she was calling me a warrior too, because she was so happy when she called them warriors, and her happiness was ours. We fell ill. First the baby, then Latinus with his round face and big ears and clear eyes, then I. I remember the strange dreams of fever. My grandfather the woodpecker flew to me and pecked my head and I cried out with the pain. In a month or so I got better, got well again. But the boy's fever would fall and then return, fall and return. They grew thin. They wasted away. They would seem to be on the mend. Lawrence would nurse eagerly at my mother's breast. Latinus would creep out of bed to play with me. Then the fever would come back and seize them. One afternoon, Latinus went into convulsions. The fever was a dog that shakes a rat to death. He was shaken to death, the crown prince, the hope of Latium, my playmate, my dear. That night, the thin little baby brother slept easily. His fever was down. Next morning early, he died in my arms with a gasp and a shiver, like a kitten. And my mother went mad with grief. My father would never understand that she was mad. He grieved bitterly for his sons. He was a man of warm feeling, and the boys had been, as a man sees it, his posterity. He wept for them, aloud at first, then for a long time in silence, for years. But he had the relief of his duties as king, and he had the rites to perform, the consolation of returning ritual, the reassurance of the ancient family spirits of his house. And I was solace to him, too, for I performed the rites with him, as a king's daughter does. And also he loved me dearly, his first-born, late-born child, for he was much older than my mother. She was 18 when they married, he was 40. She was a princess of the Rutuli of Ardea. He was king of all Latium. She was beautiful, passionate, and young. He, a man in his prime, handsome and strong, a victorious warrior who loved peace. It was a match that might have turned out very well. He didn't blame her for the boys' deaths. He didn't blame me for not having died. He took his loss and set what was left of his heart's hope on me. He went on, grayer and grimmer every year, but never unkind and never weak, except in this. He let my mother do as she would, looked away when she acted willfully, was silent when she spoke wildly. Her awful grief meant no human answer. She was left with a husband who couldn't hear or speak to her, a 6-year-old weeping daughter, and a lot of miserable, frightened women who were afraid, as servants and slaves must be afraid, that they might be punished for the children's death. For him, she had only contempt. For me, rage. I can remember each separate time I touched my mother's hand or body, or she touched mine since my brothers died. She never slept again in the bed where she and my father conceived us. After many days when she never came out of her room, she reappeared, seeming little changed, still splendid, with her shining black hair, her cream-white face, her proud bearing. Her manner and company had always been somewhat distant, rather lofty. She played the queen among commoners, and I used to marvel at how different she was with the men who thronged the king's house than she was with us children. When she sat spinning and singing and laughed and danced with us. With the house people, her manner had been imperious, willful, hot-tempered, but they loved her, for there was no meanness in her. Now she was mostly cold to them, cold to us, calm. But when I spoke, or my father spoke, often I saw the crimp of loathing in her face, the desolate, scornful fury, before she looked away. She wore the boy's bullis around her neck, the little amulet bags with a tiny clay phallus in them that boys wear for good luck and protection. She kept the bullis in their gold capsules, hidden under her clothes. She never took them off. The anger that she hid in company broke out often in the women's side of the house as fierce irritation with me. The pet name many people called me, Little Queen, particularly annoyed her, and they soon stopped saying it. She did not often speak to me, but if I annoyed her, she would turn on me suddenly and tell me in a hard, flat voice that I was a fool, ugly, stupidly timid. "You're afraid of me. I hate cowards," she would say. Sometimes my presence drove her into actual frenzy. She would strike me or shake me till my head snapped back and forth. Once the fury drove her to tear at my face with her nails. Vestina pulled me away from her, got her to her room and quieted her, and hurried back to wash the long bleeding rips down my cheeks. I was too stunned to cry, but Vestina wept over me as she put salve on the wounds. "They won't scar," she said tearfully. "I'm sure they won't scar." My mother's voice came calmly from where she was lying in her bedroom. "That's good." Festina told me to tell people that the cat had scratched me. When my father saw my face and demanded to know what had happened, I said, "Sylvia's old cat scratched me. I was holding her too tight, and a hound came by and she was frightened. It wasn't her fault." I came to half believe the story, as children will, and decorated it with details and circumstances, such as that I was quite alone when it happened, in the oak grove just outside Tyrus's farmstead, and ran all the way home. I repeated that Sylvia was not to blame, nor was the cat. I didn't want to get either of them in trouble. Kings are quick to punish. It relieves their anxiety. Sylvia was my dearest friend and playmate, and the old farm cat had a litter of suckling kittens that would die without her. So it had to be my fault alone that my face was scratched. And Vestina was right. Her comfrey salve was good. The long red furrows scabbed, healed, and left no scar, but one faint silvery track down my left cheekbone under the eye. A day comes when Aeneas traces the scar with his finger and asks me what it is. "A cat scratched me," I say. "I was holding her, and a dog frightened her." I know that there will be far greater kings of far greater kingdoms than Latinus of Latium, my father. Upriver at Seven Hills, there used to be two little fortified places with dirt walls, Janiculum and Saturnia. Then some Greek settlers came, rebuilt on the hillside, and called their fort and town Palantium. My poet tried to describe to me that place as he knew it when he was alive, or will know it when he lives, I should say. For although he was dying when he came to me, and has been dead a long time now, he hasn't yet been born. He is among those who wait on the far side of the forgetful river. He hasn't forgotten me yet, but he will, when at last he comes to be born, swimming across that milky water. When he first imagines me, he won't know that he is yet to meet me in the forest of Albania. Anyhow, he told me that in time to come, where that village is now, the seven hills and the valleys among the hills and all the riverbanks will be covered for miles with an unimaginable city. There will be temples of marble, splendid with gold on the hilltops, wide arched gates, innumerable figures carved of marble and bronze. More people will pass through the forum of that city in a single day, he said, than I will see in all the towns and farmsteads, on all the roads, in all the festivals and battlefields of Latium, in all my life. The king of that city will be the great ruler of the world, so great that he will despise the name of king and be known only as the one made great with holy power, the August. All the peoples of all the lands will bow to him and bring tribute. I believe this, knowing that my poet always speaks the truth, if not always the whole truth. Not even a poet can speak the whole truth. But in my girlhood, his great city was a rough little town built up against the slope of a rocky hill, full of caves and overgrown with thick scrub. I went there once with my father, a day's sail up the river on the west wind. The king there, Evander, an ally of ours, was an exile from Greece, and in some trouble here, too. He had killed a guest. He'd had sufficient reason for it, but that sort of thing doesn't get forgotten by our country folk. He was grateful for my father's favor and did his best to entertain us, but he lived far more poorly than our wealthy farmers. Palantium was a dark stockade, huddled under trees between the wide yellow river and the forested hills. They gave us a feast, of course, beef and venison, but served it very strangely. We had to lie down on benches at small tables, instead of sitting all together at one long table. That was the Greek fashion. And they didn't keep the sacred salt and meal on the table. That worried me all through the banquet. Evander's son, Pallas, who was about my age, 11 or 12 then, a nice boy, told me a story about a huge beast man that used to live up there in one of the caves, and came out in twilight to steal cattle and tear people to pieces. He was seldom seen, but left great footprints. A Greek hero called Heracles came by and killed the beast man. "What was he called?" I asked. And Pallas said Cacus. I knew that that meant the Fire Lord, the chief man of a tribal settlement who kept Vesta alight for the people of the neighborhood, with the help of his daughters, as my father did. But I didn't want to contradict the Greek story of the Beastman, which was more exciting than mine. Pallas asked me if I'd like to see a she-wolf's den, and I said yes. And he took me to a cave called the Lupercal, quite near the village. It was sacred to Pan, he said, which seemed to be what the Greeks called our grandfather Faunus. Anyhow, the settlers let the wolf and her cubs alone, wisely, and she let them alone, too. She never even hurt their dogs, though wolves hate dogs. There were plenty of deer for her in those hills. Now and then, in spring, she'd take a lamb. They counted that as sacrifice, and when she didn't take a lamb, they'd sacrifice a dog to her. Her mate had disappeared this past winter. It was not the wisest thing, perhaps, for two children to stand at the mouth of her den, for she had cubs and she was there. The cave smelled very strong. It was black dark inside and silent. But as I grew used to the dark, I saw the two small, unmoving fires of her eyes. She stood there between us and her children. Pallas and I backed away slowly, our gaze always on her eyes. I did not want to go, though I knew I should. I turned at last and followed Pallas, but slowly, looking back often to see if the she-wolf would come out of her house and stand there, dark and stiff-legged, the loving mother, the fierce queen. On that visit to the Seven Hills, I saw that my father was a much greater king than Evander was. Later I came to know that he was more powerful than any of the kings of the West in his day, even though he might be nothing in comparison with the great august one to come. He had established his kingdom firmly by warfare and defense of his borders long before I was born. While I was a child growing up, there were no wars to speak of. It was a long time of peace. Of course, there were feuds and battles among the farmers and along the boundaries. We were a rough people, born of oak, as they say, here in the Western land. Tempers run high. Weapons are always at hand. Now and then, my father had to intervene, put down a rustic quarrel that got too hot or spread too widely. He had no standing army. Mars lives in the plowlands and the borders of the plowlands. If there was trouble, Latinus called his farmers from their fields, and they came with their father's old bronze swords and leather shields, ready to fight to the death for him. When they'd put down the trouble, they went back to their fields, and he to his high house. The high house, the Regia, was the great shrine of the city, a sacred place, for our storeroom gods and ancestors were the Penates and Lares of the city and the people. Latins came there from all over Latium to worship and sacrifice, as well as to feast with the king. You saw the high house from a long way off in the countryside, standing among tall trees above the walls and towers and roofs. The walls of Laurentum were high and strong, because it wasn't built on a hilltop like most cities, but on the rich plains that sloped down towards the lagoons and the sea. Farmed fields and pastures lay all round it outside the ditch and earthwork, and in front of the city gate was a broad open ground where athletes played and men trained their horses. But entering the gate of Laurentum, you came out of sun and wind into deep, fragrant shade. The city was a great grove, a forest. Every house stood among oak trees, fig trees, elms, slender poplars, and spreading laurels. The streets were shady, leafy, narrow. The broadest of the streets led up to the king's house, great and stately, towering with 100 columns of cedar wood. On a shelf on each wall of the entryway was a row of images, carved by an Etruscan exile years ago as an offering to the king. They were spirits, ancestors. Two-faced Janus, Saturn, Italus, Sabinus, Grandfather Picus, who was turned into the red-capped woodpecker, but whose statue in a stiff carved toga sat holding the sacred staff and shield. A double row of grim figures in cracked and blackened cedar. They were not large, but they were the only images in human form in Laurentum, except the little clay Penates, and they filled me with fear. Often I shut my eyes as I ran between those long, dark faces with blank, staring eyes, under axes and crested helmets and javelins, and the bars of city gates and the prows of ships, war trophies nailed up along the walls. The corridor of the images opened out into the atrium, a low, large, dark room with a roof open in the center to the sky. To the left were the council and banquet halls, which, as a child, I seldom entered, and beyond them the royal apartments. Straight ahead was the altar of Vesta, with the domed brick storerooms behind it. I turned right and ran past the kitchens out into the great central courtyard, where a fountain played under the laurel tree my father planted when he was young, and lemon trees and sweet daphne and shrubs of thyme and oregano and tarragon grew in big pots, and women worked and chatted and spun and wove and rinsed out jugs and bowls in the fountain pool. I ran across among them, under the colonnade of cedar pillars, into the women's part of the house, the best part, home. If I was careful not to bring myself to my mother's attention, I had nothing to fear. Sometimes, as I grew towards womanhood, she spoke to me kindly enough, and there were a lot of women there who loved me, and women who flattered me, and old Vestina to spoil me, and other girls to be a girl with, and babies to play with, and women's side or men's side, it was my father's house, and I was my father's daughter. My best friend, though, was not a girl of the Regia at all, but the youngest child of the cattleman Tyrus, who was in charge of my family's herds as well as his own. His family farm was a quarter mile from the city gates, a huge place with many outbuildings, the stone and timber farmhouse bulking up among them like an old gray gander in a flock of geese. Cattle pens and paddocks and pastures stretched away back from the kitchen gardens among the low, oak-crowned hills. The farm was a place of endless industry, people working everywhere all day. But unless the forge was lit and the anvil clanging, or a drove of cattle was penned in close by for castration or for market, it was deeply quiet. Distant mooing from the valleys and the murmur of mourning doves and wood doves in the oak groves near the house made a continuous softness of sound into which other noises sank away and were lost. I loved that farm. Sylvia came to keep me company sometimes at the Regia, but we both preferred to be at her place. In summer, I ran out there almost every day. Tita, a slave a couple of years older than I, came with me as the guardian my status of virgin princess required. But as soon as we got there, Tita joined her friends among the farm women, and Sylvia and I ran off to climb trees or dam the creek or play with the kittens or catch pollywogs and roam the woods and hills as free as the sparrows. My mother would have kept me home. What kind of company is it she chooses to keep? Cowherds! But my father, born a king, ignored her snobbery. "Let the child run about and get strong. They're good people," he said. Indeed, Tyrus was a trusty, competent man, ruling his pastures as firmly as my father ruled his realm. He had an explosive temper, but was just with his people. He kept every feast day generously, with observance and sacrifice to the local spirits and sacred places. He had fought beside my father in the old wars long ago, and still had a bit of the warrior about him, but he was soft as warm butter when it came to his daughter. Her mother had died soon after her birth, and she had no sisters. She grew up the darling of her father and brothers and all the house people. She was in many ways more a princess than I. She didn't have to spend hours a day spinning or weaving, and had no ceremonial duties. The old cooks ran the kitchen for her, the old slaves kept the household for her, the girls swept the hearth and fed the fire for her. She had all the time in the world to run free on the hills and play with her pet animals. Sylvia had a wonderful way with creatures. In the evening, the little owls would come to her quavering call. "Hoo, oo, oo, he, e, e," and alight a moment on her outstretched hand. She tamed a fox cub. When it grew to a vixen, she let it go free. But it brought its cubs round yearly for us to see, letting them gamble in the twilight on the grass under the oaks. She reared a fawn her brothers took on a hunt, the hounds having pulled down its mother. Sylvia was 10 or 11 when they brought the little thing in. She nursed it tenderly, and it grew into a magnificent stag, as tame as any dog. He trotted off to the woods every morning, but was always back at supper time. They let him come into the dining room and eat from their trenchers. Sylvia adored her Servulus. She washed him and combed him, and decked his splendid antlers with vines in autumn and flower wreaths in spring. Male deer can be dangerous, but the stag was docile and mild, far too trusting for his own good. Sylvia fastened a broad white linen band round his neck as a sign, and all the hunters of the forest of Laysham knew Sylvia's Servulus. Even the hounds knew him, and seldom started him, having been scolded and beaten for doing so. It was a wonderful thing to be out on the hills and see a great stag come walking calmly from the forest, balancing his crown of horns. He would kneel and put his nose in Sylvia's hand, and folding his tall, delicate legs under him, sit there between us while she stroked his neck. He smelled sweet and strong and gamey. His eyes were large, dark, and quiet. So were Sylvia's eyes. That is what it was like in the age of Saturn, my poet said. The golden time of the first days, when there was no fear in the world. Sylvia seemed a daughter of that age. To sit with her on the sunlit slopes, or run with her on the forest trails she knew so well, was the delight of my life. There was no one in all that country of our girlhood who wished us any harm. Our pagans, the folk of the ploughlands, greeted us from their fields or the doorstep of their round huts. The surly beekeeper saved a comb of honey for us. The dairy women had a sip of cream for us. The cowboys showed off for us, riding bull calves or vaulting in old cow's horns. And the old shepherd, Ino, showed us how to make piping flutes of oat straw. Sometimes in summer, as the long day drew toward evening, and we knew we should be starting home to the farm, we'd both lie face down on the hillside and push our faces right into the harsh, dry grass and the hard, clotted dirt, breathing in the infinitely complex smell, hay sweet and soil bitter, of the warm summer earth, our earth. Then we were both Saturn's children. We leapt up and ran down the hill, ran home, race you to the cattle ford. When I was 15 years old, King Turnus came on a visit of state to my father. He was my cousin, my mother's nephew. His father, Daunus, ailing, had given him the crown of Rutulia the year before, and we'd heard of the splendors of the ceremonies of his coronation at Ardea, the nearest city south of Laysham. The Rutulians had been close allies of ours since Latinus married Daunus' sister, Amata. But young Turnus showed signs of wanting to go his own way. When the Etruscans of Kyri drove out their tyrant Mezentius, a savage man who held nothing sacred, Turnus took him in. Now all Etruria was angry with Turnus for receiving and sheltering the tyrant, who had abused his power so cruelly that even the Lares and the Penates of his household had forsaken him. That ill feeling was a matter of concern to us, since Kyri was just across the river. The Etruscan cities were powerful, and it behooved us to keep on good terms with them if we could. My father discussed these matters with me as we walked to the sacred forest of Albania. It lay east of Laurentum, under the hills, a day's walk. We had gone there together several times. I served as his acolyte in the rites there as he praised and propitiated our ancestors and the powers of the woods and springs. In those solitary walks, he talked to me as to his heir. Though I couldn't inherit his crown, he saw no reason why I should remain ignorant of matters of policy and government. After all, I'd almost certainly be queen of some kingdom, perhaps indeed of Rutulia. He didn't talk about that possibility, but the women did. Estina was certain of it the moment she heard of King Turnus' visit. "He's coming for our Lavinia. He's coming courting." My mother looked sharply at Vestina, across the big basket of raw wool we were all pulling. Pulling wool, drawing apart the blobs and hunks of a washed fleece to separate the fibers so they can be carded, was always my favorite housework. It's easy and perfectly mindless, and the clean fleece smells sweet, and your hands get soft from the oil in the wood, and the blobs and hunks end up as a huge, pale, airy, hairy, lovely cloud towering out of the basket. "Now that's enough of that," my mother said. "Only peasants talk about marriage for a girl her age." They say he's the most beautiful man in Italy, said Tida. And he rides a stallion nobody else can ride, said Pikula. And his hair is golden, said Vestina. He has a sister, Juturna, as beautiful as he is, but she's vowed never to leave the river, they say, said Sabella. What a gabble of geese you are, my mother said. You must have known him as a child, Queen, Sicana, my mother's favorite woman, asked. Yes, he was a fine little boy, Amata said. Very fond of his own way. She smiled a little, as she often did when she spoke of her childhood home. I went up to the watchtower in the southeast corner of the house, above the royal apartments, from which one could see down into the streets and over the city walls and gate. I saw the visitors arrive at the gate and come up the Via Regia, all mounted, with shining breastplates and nodding crests. Then I ran down to the atrium and stood with the house people while my father welcomed Turnus. I got a good look at him, his men, and his high-plumed helmet. He was splendidly handsome, well-made and muscular, with curly red-brown hair, dark blue eyes, and a proud stance. If there was any physical flaw in him, it was that he was rather short for his strong build and deep chest, so that his walk seemed a bit strutting. His voice was deep and clear. I was summoned to dinner in the great hall that day. My mother and I put on our finest light robes, with the women goose-gabbling all about us and fussing with our hair. Sicana set out for my mother the great necklace of gold and garnets that was Latina's wedding gift to her, but she put it aside and wore a necklace and earrings of silver and amethyst, which her uncle Donis had given her as a parting gift. She looked joyful and radiant. I thought that, as usual, I could hide behind her, effaced and protected by her imperious beauty. But during the meal, while Turnus talked affably with both my father and my mother, he looked at me. He didn't stare, but he looked again and again, with a slight smile. I became embarrassed as I never had been. His intense blue eyes began to frighten me. Every time I dared glance up, he was looking at me. I hadn't given any thought to love and marriage. What was there to think about? When it came time for me to be married, I'd be married, and find out what love was, and childbirth, and the rest of it. Until then, it was nothing to me. Sylvia and I could tease each other and joke about a handsome young farmer who made eyes at her, or her eldest brother, Aylmo, who sometimes hung around to talk to me. But it was all words. It meant nothing. No man in the house, in the city, in all the country, could look at me as Turnus was looking. My realm was virginity, and I was at home in it, unthreatened and at ease. No man had ever made me blush. Now I felt myself burning red from the roots of my hair, clear down to my breasts, to my knees. I cowered with shame. I couldn't eat. The besieging army was at the walls. Turnus would certainly have recognized the poet's portrait of me as a shrinking, silent maiden. My mother, beside whom I sat, was well aware of my discomfort, and it did not displease her. She let me cower, and talked away to Turnus about Ardia. I don't know if she made a signal to my father, or he came to his own decision, but as soon as the meat trenchers had been removed, and the boy had thrown the offering into the fire, and the servants were going round with ewers and napkins, and refilling wine goblets for the aftercourse, he bade my mother send me away. "We are losing the flower of the feast," the visiting king protested graciously. "The child needs her sleep," said my father. Turnus lifted his cup. The double-handled gold goblet from Kouris, engraved with a hunting scene, loot from one of my father's wars, our best piece of tableware, and said, "Fairest of all the daughters of Father Tiber, may you have sweet dreams." I sat paralyzed. "Get along with you," my mother murmured to me, with something like a laugh. I slipped out as quick as I could, barefoot, for I didn't want to stop to put my sandals on. I heard Turnus' resonant voice behind me in the hall, but not what he said. My ears were ringing. The night air in the courtyard was like cold water dashed over my hot face and body, making me gasp and shiver. In the women's side, I was, of course, pounced on by all the girls and women, telling me and one another how glorious and gorgeous the young king was, how big and tall, how he'd hung up his helmet and a huge sword and a gilt bronze breastplate like a giant's in the hall, and asking me what had he said at dinner, and did I like him? I couldn't answer. Festina helped me drive them all away, saying I looked feverish and needed to go to bed. After I'd finally persuaded her, too, to leave me alone, I could lie in my bed in my small silent room and look at Turnus. Of course, it was foolish to ask if I liked him. A young girl meeting a man, a handsome man, a king, who may be her first suitor, does not like or dislike him. Her heart beats, her blood runs, and she sees him only, maybe as the rabbit sees the hawk, maybe as the earth sees the sky. I saw Turnus as a city sees a splendid stranger, a captain of armies at the city gate. That he was there, that he had come, was wonderful and terrible. Nothing would ever be the same again. But there was no need yet to unbar the gate. Turnus stayed several days with us, but I met him again only once. He requested my presence at dinner on his last evening, and I was sent in to the feast, but not to eat with the guests and company, only for the aftercourse, to hear the singing and see the dancers. I sat with my mother, and again Turnus looked often at me, making no effort to disguise it. He smiled at us. His smile was a pleasant, quick flash. When he was watching the dancers, I looked at him. I noticed how small his ears were, that his head was well-shaped, that his jaw was square and strong. He might get jowly later in life. The back of his neck was pleasant, smooth. I saw that he was attentive and respectful to my father, who, sitting near him, looked old. My mother was 10 or 12 years older than her nephew, but tonight she did not look it. Her eyes shone and she laughed. She and Turnus got on well together and were at ease. They talked lightly across the table, and the other guests joined in, and my father listened to them benevolently. The day after Turnus left, my father sent for me and my mother. We walked under the portico outside the banquet hall. He had sent away all the people that usually were around him. It was a rainy spring day, and he was wearing his toga, for as he got older, he felt the cold. He paced with us in silence for a while, and then said, "The Rutulian king began to say to me last night that he wishes to be a suitor for your hand, Lavinia. I did not let him go on. I said that you are not yet of an age for me to permit talk of courtship or marriage. He would have argued, of course, but I did not let him argue. I said my daughter is too young." He looked at us both. I had no idea what to say. I looked at my mother. "You gave him no encouragement at all?" Amata asked, calm and civil, as she always was with her husband. "I didn't say that she'll always be too young," my father answered in his mild, dry way. "King Turnus has a great deal to offer his bride," she said. "He does indeed. Good land down there. He's a good fighter, too, they say. His father certainly was. I am sure he is a brave warrior, and wealthy." We paced on down the portico. Rain pattered in the courtyard. The leaves of the lemon trees nodded. Under the big laurel tree it was still quite dry, and one of the house girls sat there spinning and singing a long spinning song.
"So you might favor the boy if he comes back another year?"
my father asked my mother.
"I might," she said coolly, "if indeed he is willing to wait."
"And you, Lavinia?"
"I don't know," I said. He put his hand on my shoulder.
"Don't worry about it, my dear," he said. "There's plenty of time for this sort of thing."
"What would you do about tending Vesta?" I said. I could not bring myself to say, "if I went off to be married."
"Well, we must think about that. Choose a girl to whom you can begin to teach the duties."
"Maruna,"
I said at once. An Etruscan?
Her mother is. You took her on a raid across the river. Maruna grew up here. She's pious. By that word I meant responsible, faithful to duty, open to all. My father had taught me the meaning of the word and the value of it.
Good. Take her with you when you tend the fire and clean the hearth and make the sacred salt. Let her begin to learn all these matters.
My mother had nothing to say in this. It is the king's daughter who keeps his hearth alight. It was bitter to both my parents, I know, that when we sat to dinner every day, the boy who fed the altar fire with our food and spoke the blessing was not their son, as he should have been, but only a servant boy. Now the care of the fire and the storerooms, too, must go to a substitute, a slave. My father sighed a little. His large, warm, hard hand was still on my shoulder. My mother paced forward, impassive. As we turned to walk back down under the columns, she said, "It might be well not to make that young king wait too long."
"A year, or two, or three," Latinus said.
"Oh," and she winced with disgust and impatience. "3 years! The man is young, Latinus. He has hot blood in his veins.
All the more reason to give our girl time to grow up."
Amata did not argue. She never argued, but she shrugged. I read in her shrug her disbelief that I would ever grow to be a match for such a man as Turnus. Indeed, I wondered how I could. To mate with such a man, I should be deep-breasted and majestic like my mother, fierce like her, and fiercely beautiful. I was short and thin, sunburnt, uncouth. I was a girl, not a woman. I put my hand up on my father's hand on my shoulder and held it there as we walked. I could look at blue-eyed Turnus in the darkness of my room at night, but I did not want to think about leaving my home. Aeneas' armor hangs in the entryway of our house, here in Lavinium, as Turnus' sword and breastplate hung on his visits to Laurentum. I have seen Aeneas wear the armor several times, the helmet, cuirass, greaves, with the long sword and the round shield, all of bronze. He shines as the sea glances and dazzles under the sun. To see his armor hanging there is to realize what a large, powerful man he is. He doesn't look large, or even very muscular, because his body is in perfect proportion, and he moves lightly and gracefully, considerate of who and what is around him, not shoving forward, as many big, strong men do. Yet I can hardly lift the armor he wears so easily. It was a gift from his mother, who had it made for him by a great fire lord, he told me. Indeed, the man who forged and worked that armor was the Lord of Smiths. There is in all the Western world no work so beautiful as that shield. The surface of the 7 layers of welded bronze is covered all over with a great pattern of figures embossed and delicately carved and picked out with gold and silver inlay. Here and there is a slight dent or scratch from battle. I stand and study that shield often. The picture I like best is high on the left, a wolf who turns her sleek neck back to lick her suckling cubs. But the cubs are human babies, boys, greedy at her teats. Another I like is a goose, all done in silver, who stands with her neck upstretched, hissing in alarm. Behind her, some men climb a cliff. Their hair is curly gold, their cloaks are striped with silver. Around his neck, each man has a twisted collar of gold. Not far from the wolf are figures I recognize from our festivals, some leaping priests with 2-lobed shields, and a pair of wolf boys running naked, brandishing their thorn sticks at laughing women. There are a few women here and there in the pictures, but mostly it is men fighting, endless battle scenes, men torn apart, men disemboweled, bridges torn down, walls torn down, slaughter. Aeneas is not in any of the pictures, and nothing the poet told me about the siege and fall of his city or his wanderings before he came to Latium is recognizable on the shield. "Are these scenes of Troy?" I ask him, and he shakes his head.
I do not know what they are, he says. They may be scenes of what is yet to come.
What is yet to come is mostly war, then, I say, looking among them for some that aren't battles, for an unhelmeted face. I see a mass rape, women screaming and fighting as they are dragged off by warriors. I see great beautiful ships with banks of oars, but the ships are all at war. Some are burning. Fire and smoke rise up over the water. I think it may be the realm our son's sons will inherit, he says very low. Aeneas always speaks out of silence, seldom at length, usually in a low voice. He is never sullen, but he is quiet. He handles words as he handles his sword, only when he has to. That is my poet's Rome, then, the great city and many of the pictures. I look more closely at the center of the shield, the sea battle. On the stern of a ship stands a man with a handsome, cold face. Fire streams from his head, and a comet hovers over it. I think that is the man made great, the august one. As I continue looking, I see things I never observed before. The city, or some great city, lies all in ruins, utterly destroyed and burned. I see another destroyed city, and another. Enormous fires burst out in a line, one after another, enveloping a whole countryside in flame. Huge machines of war crawl on the ground, or dive under the sea, or hurtle through the air. The earth itself burns in oily black clouds. Now, an immense round cloud of destruction rises up over the sea at the end of the world. I know it is the end of the world. I say to Aeneas in horror, "Look, look!" But he cannot see what I see in the shield. He will not live to see it. He must die after only 3 years, and widow me. Only I, who met the poet in the woods of Albania, can keep looking through the bronze of my husband's shield to see all the wars he will not fight. The poet made him live, live greatly, so he must die. I, whom the poet gave so little life to, I can go on. I can live to see the cloud above the sea at the end of the world. I burst into tears and clasp Aeneas in my arms, and he holds me tenderly, telling me not to cry, dear heart. Don't cry.